let's use this time to...
Okay. In this session, I'll remind you a bit about IFRS 8 and also update you on how the post-implementation review process has developed since we met in March of this year. And when we discuss the questions, I'll also try and give you a flavor for the messages that we've received to date on some of these questions, just so that you can see if that chimes with your own experience. We are here, obviously, to learn what you think about these things. So to the extent that you have any comments as we go along, then by all means, just leap in with them. Very quickly on slide two, just to remind you, the post-implementation review process was added to the trustees' requirements for the ISB in 2007, and it was largely as a result of controversy that arose about IFRS 8. The post-implementation review can be held at any time. The original requirement was that it should be 2 years after the implementation of the standard. You may notice it's several years, actually, after the implementation date of IFRS 8, and that's because we've had mixed messages as to what that timing should be. Some people have said if you leave it longer than 2 years, people will have forgotten what the effect of implementation was. The more general view is that 2 years after a standard goes live, there isn't enough data out there to actually tell what the effect of it is. In Q1 of this year, we consulted quite widely with everyone. This is the first post-implementation review that we've done, and we put quite a lot of effort into trying to get that right. So when we met you in March, you helped us develop a list of the issues that we thought we should investigate as part of this process. And at that time, we had already, in consultation with the trustees, extended the timing of the post-implementation review. And we'd also agreed to widen the objective. Originally, the objective of a post-implementation review was just to look at contentious issues. We've really widened it to include any of the effects of the standard itself. And we've developed the methodology since we met in March. The trustees were keen that whatever the outcome of this process is and whatever conclusions the ISB would draw as a result of this review process, that that process should be fully transparent and that people would be able to see what information the ISB had received and test how those conclusions had been reached. So in April of this year, the trustees introduced a public consultation phase into the process, and we issued a request for information in July. Now, it's called a request for information rather than a request for views because we are actually asking people for evidence about what they think the effect was to try and see if that will help us pin down what the real causes behind the effect was. On slide three, we compare IFRS 8 with IS 14. I imagine most of you are aware of the differences, but just to remind you, IS 14 was a very heavily defined standard. It told you that your operating segments were either the goods and services you provided to your customers or the geography. One was your primary segment, one was your secondary segment, so you reported information about both. You had reported line items that you had to disclose. There were more, considerably more, for your primary segment, fewer for your secondary segment, and all of the line items were measured in accordance with IFRS. So the operating segment note of IS 14 agreed directly to the financial statements. IFRS 8 takes a completely different point of view. It takes the management perspective. So that you identify segments based on the operating segments that your chief operating decision maker looks at. You report the line items that he regularly reviews when he's making decisions, and those line items are measured in accordance with the internal basis of management reporting. And because of that, the IFRS 8 segment note will not necessarily agree with your financial statements. It may be different because there are some segments which aren't included in reporting segments, particularly cost centers and HQs. Things may be measured differently, so that would be a difference. And there also may be differences in the definition of the line items. So if you're disclosing EBITDA, you would have to have an adjusting entry for amortization and depreciation. Now, on slide four, we detail some of the effects that the ISB expected at the time of implementing IFRS 8. The stated objective of the standard originally was convergence with the US, and it has achieved that relatively efficiently and at little cost. The two standards are virtually identical. But the board also expected that there'd be a number of other benefits in using IFRS 8. The principal benefit would be that investors would now be able to see the segments. It would give them a clearer understanding of the business. They'd be able to see the risks that management are managing each day. Another benefit would be that because the operating segment was based on the internal management perspective, the management commentary would agree exactly with the operating segment. Now, at the time, the board were aware that there were some contentious issues. People thought that there would be a lack of comparability between entities because the internal structure and reporting structure will vary. People were also concerned that where you had reorganizations, you would lose trend information. And people were very much concerned, particularly in Europe, that you wouldn't get geographical analyses. And then just the final bit of background on slide five, the effect of implementation of IFRS 8. IFRS 8 predates the formal effect analysis process, but when we issued IFRS 8, we thought that IFRS 8 would be much less burdensome for preparers. We thought that the incremental costs of applying IFRS 8 would be low because the information reported about operating segments would be provided by the existing internal systems and processes. And similarly, we didn't think there'd be significant implementation issues because you were already doing this reporting each month. There were some practical areas that we identified as being difficult. The reporting is based on the information that goes to the single chief operating decision maker. And the identification of the chief operating decision maker can be difficult. We were also people who were concerned that the aggregation guidance actually goes somewhat against the idea of identifying an operating segment because you have some quantitative thresholds that you have to reach. So if an operating segment is more than 10% of revenue, then it automatically becomes a reporting segment. When you identify all the reporting segments and you add them up, they have to come to 76%, that's 75% of your revenue, or you have to find some more. And these two issues have been referred in the past to the Interpretations Committee. There were also some other concerns that came up that the board were aware of, the commercial sensitivity in particular and the effect on smaller entities. If you're a very, very large group, 6 billion turnover, what have you, you can split your business into very high-level categories of business. The smaller you are or a smaller market, I mean, if you're in a smaller country, you may be a very big fish in that pool. You may be very small compared to a multinational. You're required to give much more information by comparison because you have fewer levels that you can actually obscure that data in. Cost of implementation, we didn't think that they would be that significant because we thought that you'd really effectively be doing what you were doing at the moment. So that's a quick gallop as to the background. Now, the evidence gathering process is new. This request for information was published in July. It's out for comment until this Friday. We also had an academic fellow who was seconded to us, and she reviewed all the available research and the public information, published information on the effect of implementing IFRS 8. That academic review went to the board in June of this year, and that'll be updated again in December. And we've done very extensive outreach on this subject. But now one thing that we've noticed, actually, is that we've had very little uptake generally compared with our more usual public consultation process. The request for information is out until this Friday, and we've had 6 comment letters. Now, admittedly, I've been a bit spoilt on revenue, where 500 to 1,000 is grist for the mill. But we're not sure why this is. Now, it's particularly noticeable that preparers are very underrepresented. I've had a couple of outreach sessions with preparers cancelled. It might just be that the past is boring. It just might not be sexy enough for people. Everyone's busy. We certainly know that. It could be that the standard's perfect. Certainly we do think that it's probably easier for some preparers, and so there's no particular reason for them to get involved. Or it could just be something that's different about this process itself. Generally, when we're doing a public consultation with people, we're talking about a proposed standard, and we're asking people to speculate about what might happen in the future if this ED became a standard. And we think that that's a different perspective and a different approach from actually asking people to say what they've had problems doing in the last 3 years in their financial reporting. And it may be that preparers and some of the firms are particularly uncomfortable about that. So we have been doing quite a lot of outreach to try and get more information in about that. The other thing that I think is interesting and that we'd be interested in is to find out how much things have actually changed. One of the messages that we're getting is that to some extent, particularly larger groups, like to streamline their reporting as much as possible. And it's noticeable that in some jurisdictions, a lot of entities didn't actually change their segments of the reporting. And we think that may be simply because they had geared up their monthly reporting to replicate their year-end reporting. And so when it changed to IFRS 8, they were already actually reporting and making decisions on the basis of IS 14. So on slide 7, we just lay out what the questions in this request for information are. Now, the first question is data about the respondents. And we've put that in particularly to help us assess what the subsequent answers mean. One thing that's noticeable as we've been speaking to people is that everyone thinks operating segments are interesting disclosure, and they want to be involved, and they have information about that. Whether or not they're using IFRS 8, whether they were using IAS 14. And so we've asked people to give us data about their job title and where their country is in the adoption of IFRS 8, just so that we've got some context to assess the information that they give us. The three big differences between IAS 14 and IFRS 8 that we want to know the effect of were the decisions that the board made when they adopted IFRS 8. And that was basically to identify the segments based on the management perspective, measure them in accordance with the internal measurement requirements, and then report the line items that the chief operating decision maker used. So those are the questions that I think are really significant. We're also asking about the effect of disclosure on the role of the respondent and also the experience of implementing IFRS 8. So today, as I said, I'll give you some feedback about the key messages we've received about each of these questions to see if it agrees with your experience. In particular, I'd like to ask you about your experience of the principal question, how you identify the operating segments to begin with and what that change, how that affected you. And that's covered by question 2, which is on slide 8, the effect of the management perspective. So the ISB, when we adopted this standard, thought that the management perspective would help investors understand the business and would help you communicate more effectively with investors. Did the basis of your segmentation change? As I said, we think that for a number of people in a number of jurisdictions, it didn't. The other question was, do the investors use the segments that you disclose, or do they ask for a different analysis? The feedback we've had from investors is that where the operating segment note agrees with the management commentary, and the management commentary provides more detail about that operating segment note, that cross-validates both of them, and investors are very happy because they feel that the management commentary is indirectly audited. We have, however, found, talking to a lot of investors, that in some jurisdictions in particular, there's a lot of mistrust with investors. They look at the segment note and they say, oh, that's all very well and good, but what do the real segments look like? They seem to think that there's another version of the segments out there somewhere. And then what sort of were the practical implications of actually implementing this? We know that the CODM was difficult to identify. What effect did the amalgamation guidance have in your reporting? And just the final bit of feedback that I'll give you on that message. I was struck last week when I was talking to a preparer in Scandinavia who said that he didn't have any difficulty identifying what his reporting segment should be, because whenever they did a business review or whenever they took decisions, they were looking at the same hierarchy and the same structure. But looking at that hierarchy, there was no way he could work backwards and articulate who the CODM must be based on that hierarchy, because there wasn't a single sort of body or a single person that seemed to be applicable for all of those different decisions. So any comments on the operating segment basis?
Yeah, I think we have a couple here. One is Malcolm first, then Jayan second.
So I don't want to hog the debate and neither hog all the critical comments, but for example, you issued this. Why did it just go to my CFO? Why was it not part of my sort of subscription package? Because I happened to get it from my CFO, but I know it was on the website, but it was not sent very broadly to people. Secondly, the question that you phrase, that you want to know who the title is of the person responding, it's very much written as if you're just looking for comments from a company. And obviously, many times we make comments from organizations. So you've actually perhaps given the impression that you just wanted it from companies and not from organizations. So don't worry, you'll be getting extra letters from Switzerland by the end of this week, because we worked on it. And the other point why it's perhaps not considered that relevant for many IFRS preparers is, don't forget, IFRS preparers were having to follow IAS 14. Therefore, there was no, and that's perhaps why, certainly in Switzerland, I think of the top 20 companies we surveyed, only two decided to change, because they were already complying with IAS 14, they got all their systems in place, so there was no change to go to IAS 8. What has come out, though, from the debate is actually quite interesting, is that many people actually quite like IAS 8 prospectively. As you introduce more and more accounting standards which perhaps inhibit us from running our business, as we, you know, some of these standards which are for fair value, most likely what's going to happen is we're going to more and more keep using our way of running the business and only implement some of the more complex standards at the total company level, but not in the segment. So what actually came out of our debate last Friday that we had in Switzerland is actually, even though very few of the companies, you know, me and my company included, actually made big changes. That's why our comments, you know, would say, well, it was a non-event, because we kept IAS 14, our systems were set up. Most likely in the future, we will like IAS 8 because it will enable us to keep our segments sort of pure. We don't have to put certain things in our segments that we perhaps don't like. We will only put that information in the total aggregated figures. So perhaps the point I'm trying to say is, it was written that the questions were written, well, what was the impact for you as historically, is this going to give you potentially future benefits? And we actually see that IAS 8 potentially could give us future benefits. IFRS 8 could give us future benefits, because it will enable us to keep our segment reporting as we look at it in management, and not necessarily be forced to introduce some of the more complex standards into the segment report. So I don't know if that's...
I don't know why it wasn't sent to all members of EFRS. I know we did send out an email alert, but I hadn't realized that was just sent to selected people.
I agree. The email went to everybody. I agree. And it's on the website for everybody. But the actual document was only, you know, it was a personal letter from Hans to CFOs, which might have, and as I say, the very fact that first question clearly says, well, what's your position in the company? It's written as if you're only expecting responses from companies, not from organizations.
There is, I agree, a hitch perhaps in the wording of the RFI, because what we've done at the bottom of each question is we've put specific questions for preparers of accounts and specific detailed questions for investors, because we felt that they needed more help with understanding what the process was. That doesn't mean we're not interested in organizations or auditors or regulators or standard setters. It's just that we thought that they would more carefully understand what the process was likely to be.
Yeah, I have two, three comments to make. One thing, you mentioned that probably you haven't got many responses. The reason could be that this is something we've already been doing. I mean, it's one of the easy things. The changes are not much. Having said that, there are two issues. One is that most of the corporates are already reporting the primary segment and the secondary segment. And if you look at the investor world or the analyst world, they're expecting that. So going ahead, whether we have the option or not, most likely preparers will continue to do it, especially for the corporates who have got multi-geographical presence. That would be important. And the third thing, you know, there's always a conflict. I mean, you also mentioned that what is a reported segment, what is a true segment. But as a preparer, there is nothing for me to complain. But still, it doesn't define what a true segment is. It's left to the management of the company, and probably as a preparer, we'll continue to deal the way we have been doing. But this issue would keep on coming, what a true segment is, especially from the user's point of view. So maybe it should have addressed.
Yeah.
Well, I joined the Micomt purpose that first, when we were on IS 14, we already had segments that were the same than the one they are today, because the business is the same. So maybe it's different from a group to another. If one has changed a lot of his business, it may have changed 1 year from another, but if you are always on the same businesses, you should not have changed only because you've changed the standard. That's the first thing. The second thing is we have always given information according to IFRS GAAP. So the external information up to date is completely in accordance with IFRS as adopted by the European Union. But if once the information is too far from what the groups think that it should represent, I think about IFRS 11, for example, we may change our point of view, not because it's IFRS 8 against IFRS 14, because it is IFRS 8 that will mean something according to the group's view, because IFRS 11 has taken away that could not give us the opportunity to present, for example, the growth in revenue in some countries. So maybe if some standards go too far from what is a good representation of our business, we will have to change.
Can I ask you both a question, though? This is, I'm not trying to be, to use Kevin's words, I'm not trying to be a regulator. So don't even, I'm not even trying to be an auditor. So I'm just asking a simple question. My understanding, by the time I started learning IFRS, IAS 14 was gone. So IFRS 8 is the only one I learned. But I think I know the big difference between the two. The big difference between the two is that IAS 14 requires you to show your segments as prepared under IFRS, whereas IFRS 8 gives you the discretion to do it or the management views it. While IAS 14 did not give you the ability, IFRS 8 gives you. But if what is really, like, to the point that few people have raised, what is the really the management is looking into the segment? What basis the management
is? The same
is
for us, and we have not that question. It's just exactly, we always have the same businesses, and
it could be same business, but do you view it the same way?
According to IFRS 14 or according to IFRS 8, it is the same businesses, so we have made no change.
If I may become very honest, the answer is no.
No?
No change.
The way the management says internally, not always it is reported externally.
PK, I'll tell you what we did, because we did swap when IFRS 8 came out. Because under IAS 14, we were just pure IFRS approach, but our management accounts, hedging wasn't in the management accounting. Proportionate consolidation is management accounting. So we did. We have reconciliations. Our segment reporting reconciles to the financial statements because they aren't the same.
Yeah, I saw similar things, which was, and this touches on one of the problems I've got with using the actual numbers that management look at rather than the segments, which I disagree with. So, for example, in management reports, you classically see performance done at budget rates of exchange. Okay, so you can compare current year against budget and against prior year, or on the same set of exchange rates. Now, what that means, and I've asked this question specifically, is that when your current year becomes your prior year in your financial statements, then those current year numbers, if the exchange rates have changed. Okay, fantastic. Go and explain that to analysts. So what I've done in companies I've worked in is I've said, okay, my management reporting will upfront state everything at actual exchange rates. And the primary things my chief operating decision maker sees is based on actual exchange rates. So then I can then use that in my segment reporting. If my chief operating decision maker then chooses to use budget rates of exchange, and that's fine. So behaviours did change to respond to some of the things in IFRS 8, which arguably weren't, again, unintended consequences, or consequences that perhaps were not considered so well or identified.
And I think perhaps part of those characteristics reflect the fact that IFRS 8, which evolved from FAS 131, was a very old standard indeed. Yeah. And I think that didn't really reflect the changes that have been made in systems and reporting.
And it may have been because FAS 133 was, with due respect to my US colleagues, may have been a US standard which is probably more focused on US operations perhaps, and perhaps didn't sort of get to the dynamics of operations on a more global basis.
So you know, I don't know, perhaps you're already doing it, Kevin, but, you know, those, let's talk about proportionate consolidation, those entities that are sort of really wedded to that principle might still feel in their segments they want to report that way and just do the adjusting entries in the aggregate figures. Now, you can say it's fine, but are you necessarily going to get comparability across all the segments, all the industries in that segment? Because you'll have certain ones having that management view and other ones having a different management view.
But I think the thrust of IFRS 8 or the US FAS 131 is to look through the eyes of the management. And so from that point of view, I think it's a very valid way to do it, is not to look at the gap, but look at how the management looks at its operations. So that gives a very good, perhaps, insight into the how the management manages each segment for the users.
Yeah. Even if certain segments, I mean, we had big debates when share-based compensation got introduced. Do we actually have to allocate that to the segments or not? We decided, because we were under IAS 8 at the time, share-based compensation had to be allocated to the segments, as did service costs from, you know, IAS 19, etc. One could well imagine that US companies that were not following IAS 14 at the time actually didn't do that allocation. So what you're going to see is, over time, you're going to have less and less companies following their segment reporting the full IFRS standards. So you're not going to have them following in the segment reporting, taking away proportionate consolidation. You're not going to have some of their values adjustment perhaps reported in the segment reporting. You could conceivably even have different revenue measurement principles followed. You could have percentage of completion followed. I don't know. There's a lot of flexibility now in IFRS 8 that wasn't there. IFRS 8 that wasn't there.
Malcolm, I think what you're really raising as an issue is whether the reconciliation between the segment, through the eyes of management, measure of performance at the segment level, which is reconciled to the gap figures, IFRS figures at the total level, whether that should be done at the segment level instead of at the group. Because the comparability between two companies having two different views about proportionate consolidation can be reconciled at the total level, consolidated level, because there is a requirement in IFRS 8 to reconcile. Now, if you look at the segments only and you compare one company with a sister company in the same business, same industry, you will have two different views and no comparability at the segment level, which is a point I think April we are discussing in the post-implementation review, is whether the reconciliation should be done at the segment level, as many analysts do ask for.
And I think just two messages that we've heard on that. The first one about the reconciliation. A lot of investors have asked that the reconciliation should be done segment by segment. Of course, if you speak to the firms or to preparers, the whole reason why they haven't actually put those reconciling items out into the segment is because they don't know what basis to allocate those adjustments into. So whether or not that reconciliation would be meaningful for them. Now, for something like proportional consolidation, yes, they would know which entities were in each division, and they could adjust for that. But for some of the larger adjustments, they couldn't be. The other thing, just as an aside on the basis of segmentation, is that when IFRS 8 was published and throughout this process, there's been a howl about it, you can't compare the segments now under IFRS 8 between two entities. And I think the question to think about is, could you ever actually do that? Under IS 14, if you were looking at an engineering group which had, I don't know, turbines, trains, six business lines, would those have been the same business lines as another engineering group who would have had some products in common, but who would have, for operational reasons, have put them with another division? So I'm not convinced personally that you could ever compare the segments between entities under IS 14 or IFRS 8.
Sandra?
Yes, looking at the whole process, the types of companies that are going to respond to this request for information are those that probably had to change or chose to change. So you're going to end up with a bias in your responses versus having a fair representation from all of your constituents. I know in the U.S. we felt that we should respond to the business combination one because we had such a large acquisition. Had we not had a major acquisition, we would have chose not to respond to that. But you have got to participate when you have one of the largest transactions. So segment reporting, they're not going to respond unless it impacted them.
Although it's interesting, the only respondent we've had so far who is a preparer has just written to say we didn't change.
What was that?
Well, that's easy.
It was a Swiss responder who actually just wrote to say we didn't change. So it's an easy letter to write.
Yeah, but I'm a little worried about that. Anyway, Hiroshi?
I think the preparer's response is limited because they are satisfied with IFRS 8. In Japan, we are now using almost the same standard of IFRS 8. And I think some drawbacks, such as the comparability, some aspect of comparability is lost, but the benefit outweighs the drawbacks because the numbers disclosure is used by management. So investors want to listen to the voices of the management. So IFRS is contribute to communication between management and investors. As in my experience, more than half of the questions from analysts and investors and the press are related segment reporting. So I think it's very useful. And do you remember in a project at the financial statement presentation, which is now suspended, the FSB was thinking to require much detailed information of gap information for each segment, and they also thinking to require the segment information of cash flows. But I think that's too much.
Yeah.
I think the current standards of IFRS 8 very good. but you may not receive comment. But you could, you need to think they do not present comment if they are satisfied.
Just out of curiosity, before I ask Martin to speak, April, we know that the FASB has conducted its FAST 131 to the trustees. Just to curiosity, what is the flavor of the comments there? Because they are similar standards, almost identical standards?
I mean, we don't actually know. As it happens, I'm speaking to the staff later today to find out where they've got to. We know that they're very advanced in their review, and I believe it'll be going to them shortly. But the process between our review and their review is really fundamentally different.
Different, yes.
Because they're looking at a standard that was in operation for 15 years, and they're now looking at what the effect was. They're doing it, our trustees were very clear that this is part of the IASB's due process and it should be done and understood by the IASB. The US takes the opposite view. It's done by the trustees, by a third party on an anonymous basis with no transparency. No one knows who replies or, you know, what they said, not even the FASB. So they're very different processes with quite different objectives. And the reason that the staff on both sides have been sort of monitoring each other is simply to make sure that we're not getting wildly discordant messages. Our objectives are different, and the people we're doing it for are different. And we all only just really want to see that if there are different messages, we understand the reason. And there could be different messages because what's being compared in the US is different, really, from what's being compared here, and the timescale of that is different. So, for example, I think there is something like 100 questions that were sent out for the trustees' review. And one of them, for example, says, if you were doing this job 14 years ago, what was the effect of implementing FAS 131 on you? Whereas we're much broader questions and looking at a much sort of broader position. But when we do come back to the IASB, part of our preliminary findings will be a sort of a memorandum update as to what we think the significance of the
So next time when we meet here in this group, it might be February, so hopefully by that time we will have a good analysis.
We should have some sort of analysis then.
Martin?
Yeah, I want to give only one comment to the question on why do we have not seen really from the move from IAS 14 to IFRS 8 so many changes how companies have reported their segments. And based on my experience, when I worked in a company where we have tried, or and sometimes we had difference between really what we reported in the segments regarding definition, what is revenues, what is costs, compared to what is defined under IFRS. And with a consequence that really that we had a huge reconciliation from our segment results to the group results, and really the message from the analysts and from the users were, okay, we too difficult to understand, and we really, our share price had a discount. And that is, I think, one reason, I think, why people have not really moved too far away from really what is IFRS rules compared to management accounting rules. Second argument is, I think, if you are a big company, and I think your valuation of the company by analysts is often done as some of the parts valuation, and some of the parts valuation is really compared to other companies, and if you, in your segment reporting, are too far away regarding your definition of numbers compared to other companies which are standalone then, and analysts want to compare really and do the evaluations, that is also a good argument why it should be wise not to be far away in your segment reporting from what is defined under IFRS. So I really wanted to give these two reasons why I think really people and companies have not moved under IFRS so far away from what is defined in IFRS as revenues, costs, and the rules. Thanks.
I was thinking about something April said, and Sandra's point as well, about respondent bias. And it seems to me it's particularly likely that we'll get biased responses to this compared with what we get to an exposure draft. Let's say it's only going to be the people who feel really strongly that things have gone badly we'll hear from. And I was just wondering whether you as a group can actually help us try and overcome that bias to some extent, either by trying to encourage people who agree with things to send in responses, or at least if we can organise some discussion among this group, for example, to help us try and counteract that and get a more balanced picture.
comment. Bill?
Yeah, I think the fact that question one asks you to reveal yourself is quite troublesome, in that you may find that people are sensitive about responding to the questions which might give out information that they'd rather not give out to competitors, etc., etc. Often these discussions internally are very sensitive. Who is the CODM, for example? What process did you go through to identify? Will the CODM change as, you know, business circumstances change so that an executive board can be more empowered because the financial situation has improved and then it's drawn back again? So that might be one of the ways. I'm presuming all the replies are made public. I'm presuming all the replies are public.
Yeah, the request for information is a public document and the replies will be public, and I think that's why, that's one of the reasons we've only had six, and why we've put so much emphasis on outreach, because I think this process of what people have been doing in the past, I think, is much more sensitive, particularly for preparers and the firms. And certainly speaking, say, to the firms, a number of firms have been prepared to speak to us quite openly, privately, but we haven't seen public letters yet, and whether some of the public letters may have to be truncated simply to protect clients, I don't know.
Yeah, it may be that, for example, yes, the way this has been disseminated through individual letters and what have you doesn't respond to, say, the 100 Group or the CBI or any other UK groups responding as a group, where you might get better information, because then sort of specifics are...
Well, it should actually have gone to those organisations, because those organisations should have been on the list. I mean, I'll check.
Yeah, they may not just have disseminated.
Yeah, we might want to check with Sonia on that.
That was the intention, yeah.
Not disseminated through my groups. I'll pick that up with my groups.
But coming back to Peter's specific request, I counted there are 14 or 15 people in this room. What about their thought? Any expression of interest or disinterest on that idea, what Peter suggested about countering it? Because I think Sandra's point is well taken. How do we do that? Because we are not looking for a bias. We are looking for a balanced view. And we just want to think through that and see how best we can do it. Otherwise, we can end up with the wrong standard after our implementation. That may not be good either. Any thoughts?
I mean, I think to some extent our responses are always rather biased. It tends to be people who, even when we're looking at an exposure draft, feel they'll be adversely affected who reply, rather than the people who feel they'll be favourably.
That's true, but I think there's one different factor in this case. Quite a lot of you respond to pretty much every exposure draft anyway, and that there is a pool of, I don't know, probably 50 or 100 that respond to most things, but I suspect we may not get that for the post-implementation review, so I think it'll be a more skewed sample probably.
But, I think Bill or Malcolm suggested that each business organization in each jurisdiction, you should make sure they do reply.
Yeah,
and probably a business organization will have a more balanced response because it's a consensus than any single company which will.
But it's a bit late. It's a bit late to do that. So if you know, you might need to think about giving an extra month. If you really by the end of this week don't get many in, you perhaps need to give an extra month and widen it to business organizations or something. Because, as I say, we happened to have had our discussion last Friday. And as a result of that discussion, you'll see that you know, we actually are going to give you some of the views I've just expressed, which I think might be useful for you. But it's written as the organization. We as I say, we had to find a way of accommodating those companies that did change against those where it was a non-event. And
If we want to act on Malcolm's request of an extended time, should that need to come back to the board for the extension, or how does that work?
Well, this effect we've been aware of for some time. We've been aware of this for some months, which is why we've really ramped up the outreach, and we've done an awful lot of outreach on this to get the information in privately through private conversations and through interviews with people. So that I think when we come to do the preliminary analysis for the board, much more so than for other projects, it will be as well an outreach summary.
Okay.
PK, we should maybe bring it up at the admin meeting next week and see whether we, the board has an appetite to just decide now or wait. I think it's good input for the admin meeting next week.
I had thought this had been raised at an admin meeting already. Is it or not? No, obviously not.
No, not
by knowledge.
Any other thoughts before we take the much needed coffee break?
I mean, just to let you know that the next stage is that we will be preparing a preliminary analysis of the preliminary findings for the board. That will include an update of the academic findings, the comment letters, the outreach messages that we've received. And then when that goes to the board can then assess whether they've got enough information to come to any conclusions, whether they need more information, and what a suitable response would be to those concerns.
And you promised to come back to us in February to this group to,
yes,
to tell what happened in the U.S., what happened here, and all that.
Will there be caterers? Yes.
Okay. Anything else you want to cover today, April? Or?
That's fine. Thank you.
Then should we meet at 3 o'clock and discuss revenue? Then our good old Bob will talk about XBRL after that.